Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Anya Kamenetz is a journalist focused on generational justice. Her current projects include a kids' climate podcast for Noggin, Nickelodeon's educational brand, and work with K-12 Climate Action to include climate in children's storytelling. Anya has previously worked as an education correspondent for NPR and a staff writer for Fast Company magazine. She's contributed to the New York Times, Washington Post, New York Magazine, and Slate, and has won multiple awards for her reporting on education, technology, and innovation. She's the author of four books, Generation Debt, DIYU, The Test, and The Art of Screen Time. Anya's new book is The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives, and Where We Go Now. Info at anyakamenetz.net. Coming up, we'll talk about what the impacts were of keeping students out of school as long as we did during the pandemic, why this past school year was so challenging for students and educators, and why it's so important for schools to prioritize relationships and social-emotional well-being moving forward.
I've seen schools really move social-emotional well-being and prioritizing relationships to the top of the agenda, and it's something we've talked about for a long time, maybe paid lip service to, but I think most teachers, school leaders have really internalized the importance of this because they saw that the key thing that helped students participate and stay engaged with school was whether they felt that there was an adult at the school who cared about them.
But first, Anya, how did your family weather the pandemic closures?
Well, thank you for asking that. When the pandemic started, I had a 3-year-old and an 8-year-old daughter. My husband and I both worked from home and we had access to a little bit of childcare from our downstairs neighbor, which is a real lifesaver. I would say that they've been pretty resilient and we've been really lucky in terms of the amount of resources we've been able to dedicate to balancing their need for socialization and learning with the safety of everyone involved. There are subtle impacts that have to do with my kids' social maturity or just their ability to, you know, have little experiences like my kindergartner now going to be a first grader. She's never had a sleepover, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something that my older kid was able to do at a younger age. But overall, I think we're on the luckiest end of things.
As you describe your experiences with your own family and your own daughters, you mentioned that it was great to have the resources to sort of cushion the blow of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of families that didn't have those resources, or the children in the families had special needs or needed extra supports, like children with disabilities, for example, or children who lived in poverty or children who were learning English.
Right.
What sorts of impacts did you see or experiences did you see during the pandemic closures for families in those circumstances?
I'll tell you a story about a little girl that I think about a lot, and I call her Serena in the book. And she was the daughter of an immigrant who had come from Peru about 10 years before, and she was 4 years old when the pandemic started. She and her mother paid $1,000 a month in rent in the Outer Sunset District, sharing a bed in a room in a shared house. And when school shut down, her only option was to go on the bus with her mother to her mother's job, cleaning hotel rooms. She experienced kindergarten on her mother's phone for the most part, which wasn't really conducive to learning English or learning to read or to write. She and her mother also struggled with food insecurity. They spent hours standing in line for food pantries. There were behavioral issues and mental health issues that had to do with their fear of the virus, the fact that they had to ride the bus every day, go and work in an essential job, and she had to have her daughter with her, made them very afraid and wanting to avoid all but the most basic contact. There are just so many different impacts. And I think it's really important to remember because sometimes we separate out the mental health because mental health can affect people across class. Yeah. But when people are having basic needs problems, they're often having mental health issues at the same time.
The name of your book is The Stolen Year.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that particular title? Because that's a big statement.
Well, it's interesting. So one of the initial working titles was The Lost Year. And some of the pushback that I got on that was to say that we don't want to say that these kids are marked or stigmatized because of what they went through or that there's a deficit model, but it is important to point out what adults did. Adults made these choices not to prioritize children in decision-making by keeping schools closed, even when they allowed
bars to open, restaurants to open in many cases. That's why I talk about the stolen year.
Yeah, because one thing that you referenced was the fact that in other countries, it didn't look the same in terms of school as it did here in the US. What were other countries doing that was different or better?
So obviously, we can separate this out into tiers and say we would all like to be Asia Pacific, Japan, South Korea, or New Zealand and have no virus cases and be able to reopen our schools with no stress, right? Given that we were not in that group of countries, we had a very poor management of the virus itself and waves of infections that made people very afraid. That was more similar to European countries like Italy, like Spain, France, and the UK. But what was different was that all of those countries that I just mentioned committed to reopening their schools often as soon as the spring, only a month or so after they closed, but certainly by the fall, with subsequent waves of the virus, they would call partial lockdowns. They would close holiday markets, close gyms, close restaurants, and keep schools open. You know, you can argue about timing of public health measures and what's important and what's not important, but the key thing that European countries did that we did not do almost anywhere was prioritize schools as an essential service that needed to be open for families.
By keeping the schools open as they did, was there an uptick in COVID cases that they saw among kids?
There are a lot of different ways to argue this, but I think you can point big picture to the fact that within the United States, there is no clear difference in death rates by COVID by states that schools reopened in the fall, which we had many of, like Florida, like Texas, and states where they didn't. Now, there's so many different factors that you could point to about that. On the international level, America has a terrible distinction, which is we kept more of our classrooms closed, more of our students home for longer than any other wealthy country. And we have the highest death rate from COVID per capita of any other wealthy country. You can argue about the judgment of each individual case and whether you prevented spread by closing or opening the schools. But in the aggregate, it's very hard to see a benefit.
What would you say were the impacts of this by keeping the kids home or out of school as long as we did?
Well, school provides many different things to different kids. More than half of the kids in the United States are low income. 30 million out of 50 million or so are dependent on the school meals program for basic meals. So the first thing that we saw when schools closed was those programs were trying to give out sandwiches in parking lots. They reached about two-thirds fewer people that way. Family hunger spiked to unprecedented levels in April, May. That was remedied quickly, thankfully, with relief, but a month of hunger does have an impact on a kid's life.
Yeah.
Then we see the impact on learning, that remote learning was something that many different kids had very lots of trouble engaging in. Certainly kids with special needs, but also just kids that lost their motivation, because getting to the third big area that school provides, it provides this location of social contacts and meaning for kids. It's a place with caring adults, a safe place. While there's bullying and there's negative social things that go on at school, it's the most important place where kids spend time with each other. And it was a loss of that, the sense of meaning, purpose, and connection that really led to what the Surgeon General calls a public health emergency around youth mental health.
Yeah, I certainly saw that in the case of my own son, AJ. He was at the time 11. He was in the process of finishing up fifth grade. And when everything went remote, he, because of his disabilities that he has, he wasn't able to feel a sense of connection on the screen. Remote schooling wasn't real to him. The idea of being quote unquote in class just didn't click. So he became very good at technology as a result. He learned how to alt tab, for example, from Zoom to YouTube, or he learned how to use the online platform so that he could draw a mustache on the teacher, or he could take control of the meeting. He ended up teaching the teacher how to keep control of the meeting and how to use the whiteboard functions and that kind of thing. So he did develop these technology skills, but in terms of the socialization, in terms of the actual learning, there really wasn't much there. And the only way that my wife and I could help him learn was to have an adult, one of us, literally sitting next to him to make sure that he not only focused on class, but also got whatever supports that he could get, because without the supports, school just doesn't work. That was definitely an impact there, not even to mention the social aspects, not being able to see his friends. I think about what the long-term impacts could be just from the social aspects itself. Have you seen any research that might indicate what we're dealing with long-term just from the social aspect?
So I just want to respond to, you know, your incredible care and concern for your son, and also recognizing that there are ways that students tried to take control of the learning process in a very difficult situation. It sounds so similar to the boy I call Jonah in the book, mm-hmm. who also was dealing with autism, dyslexia, ADHD, and was completely captivated by technology. And I can't tell you the number of kids I knew that spent time in YouTube instead of in class. And sometimes it took weeks before teachers and parents connected over that problem. But it's like chronic absenteeism. It's a presenteeism. You might be physically in front of the computer, but you're not learning.
Right.
That's a really big problem. It sort of points to a bigger issue. Somebody said something really illuminating to me, which was that compulsory public education was this social innovation, making a law that kids had to go to school, and reciprocally, the state must provide education to all kids, including kids who are hard to teach or have, you know, need very specific services. That was a fight that took place over generations to get kids appropriate services, right? When we closed schools, we took away the compulsory aspect because you can't physically control the environment the kids are in.
Yeah.
Remotely. So that was a really major phase change. When you talk about the lack of social opportunities, so long-term impacts of that can be developmental. It can be something where, you know, they're predisposed to a mental health syndrome or a diagnosis like depression, anxiety. We're also seeing things like eating disorders that are showing up in kids and a high rate of suicidality with very young kids in the beginning of the pandemic. So the lack of social contact was really experienced as a cutoff of oxygen for some kids. They need that time with their friends. They need to play and they need to learn socially in communication with others. What is the long-term impact? Many kids sought help and a lot of kids got help, but not all kids got help. Yeah. So, you know, I think about a kid, this is not about the lack of social contact, but the family that I spent time with in St. Louis, where the mother, single mother, is raising 8 children. And one of them, the 7-year-old boy, he ran off one day because his mother had no childcare. So she was locking the door on her kids to get to work. He ran off. He was shot in a vacant building in the leg. He recovered, but he clearly had trauma from that. He was trying to process it. He would ask for toy guns every time they went to the Goodwill. He would talk about having to protect his family. Yes, they had basic needs, but again, they needed mental health services. So what happens if a kid doesn't get the mental health services that they need from something like that? We know that it can last a long time.
I'm also thinking about the closure's impact on just school climate. In other words, what it's like feeling safe, feeling welcomed, feeling a sense of belonging in school. And what we saw is after a year and a half or 2 years of closures, at least in my son's school, and I've seen this across my state, in the state of Washington, when you're basically having seventh graders who were at the tail end of fifth grade when school closed, you have expectations for seventh graders, but it's like having those expectations for fifth graders instead. So there's this social lag. That means that if a school doesn't lay out the expectations for behavior and provide supports for students to meet those expectations, you're going to have kind of a Lord of the Flies situation. So there were fights breaking out every day. The teachers, unfortunately, were in over their heads trying to manage everything. And without strong leadership, that can be a real disaster.
Yeah.
Do you see that in other places too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Last year was really rough. And anecdotally, middle school was the roughest, because it is that transitional time and because kids missed out on that maturation and just learning how to do school. The other piece of that puzzle is that teachers were incredibly burnt out and they had been through, you know, remote teaching was very, very hard. Hybrid teaching was possibly even harder. And teachers bore the brunt of the dissatisfaction that a lot of families felt with remote learning. So they were trying to meet these needs of children for positive behavior interventions and supports in school climate and social and emotional well-being with empty cups oftentimes. And that's really what we're looking at now. We're looking at, I covered a round of school closures last Thanksgiving. So this is 2021. And they're happening not only because people are calling in sick from COVID, but they are burnt out and they are using their paid time off to take long weekends through Veterans Day and through Thanksgiving. And all of a sudden there's not enough people to reopen. And so schools had to randomly close here and there 4 or 5 days. And it's really, that's not a normal situation. It doesn't normally happen that way. But I talked to school leaders who were like, look, our staff is not available. They can't do this.
there was also a lot of talk about reinventing education because it didn't work. The system that we had didn't work for a lot of students before the pandemic. And there were some bright spots as a result of the pandemic in that schools had to do something different. Were there any large takeaways from innovations that did happen during the pandemic that could be applied now?
Yes, I've seen schools really move social and emotional well-being and just prioritizing relationships to the top of the agenda. And it's something we've talked about for a long time, maybe paid lip service to, but I think most teachers, school leaders have really internalized the importance of this because they saw that the key thing that helped students participate and stay engaged with school was whether they felt that there was an adult at the school who cared about them. That can happen by accident, but it also can be cultivated. And there's lots of school models, discipline models, social emotional learning programs that can help that happen. Schools have to invest in it, though. They have to reward teachers for holding advisories and advising extracurriculars and all the things that help build those relationships.
Yeah. Is that something that we can do more of moving forward? Because I'm thinking about the path forward, how to handle the impacts, the many, many impacts of the school closures.
Yeah.
What would you recommend or what have you heard being done to remedy this long term?
So on a very basic level, schools are starting to try to offer more learning time, more tutoring, more after school programs, more summer programs. They're not necessarily tracking the efficacy of these programs, which is a huge problem in educational innovation across the board. There's definitely been a gold rush in the ed tech space as companies are saying they have the perfect solution for extra learning time and AI assistance and all these things. I do think that schools understand the power of real-time data and how to use software programs to monitor student performance and try to individualize it. So personalized learning, I think, is getting closer to the mainstream, and remote, having everyone, you know, working on computers helped increase the awareness of that and hopefully increase the integration of technology, which is what we're looking for. We're not looking for it as a silver bullet, right? Mm-hmm. I do see schools investing in mental health care, mental health professionals on site. There's lots and lots of vacancies in schools this fall that schools are trying to hire these people. And there's a pipeline issue because there was a shortage of school counselors and social workers and mental health professionals before the pandemic. So now there's a real urgency. And some districts are doing things like accepting people for internships, paying them to get trained as they stay in the school in support roles until they get certified. Yeah, there's changes going on. I don't see energy for a massive renewal of the school model because people are tired, you know, yeah. And it's been very hard. And so rather than saying we're going to do school, I don't see any country saying we're going to do school completely differently because of what we went through. But I do think that there have been certain capacities that have grown. And when I talk to school leaders, I always prompt them to think about what do you know how to do now that you didn't know how to do before? And I think there's a lot.
Well, if you were U.S. Secretary of Education and there were no budgetary constraints, what would you do?
I would use my bully pulpit to really publicize efficacy and evaluations of the interventions. How are schools using this ESSER money? There's this huge intervention of $122 billion. And schools just got an extension on spending the money because apparently districts weren't able to find enough places to spend it fast enough, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. But let's have a very public conversation about where that money's going and how do we know that we're spending it in the right places. That's something that the education department can uniquely do, is spend money on evaluation and publicize best practice.
Would you prioritize family engagement and student engagement in the process?
Yes, I should step back a moment and say, schools have lost a lot of kids. There was a big drop in enrollment, public schools in particular. Yeah. And it has started to rebound more so in red states than blue states. But there's demographic headwinds. So the overall picture with birth rates and with immigration is that there will be fewer students. And that's really hard when you run a big public service. But I think that there's an urgency, a super urgency right now to deal with kids who have been chronically absent these last few years, who are on the verge of dropping out. And that takes dedicated people and professionals and every person in the school building seeing their responsibility to keep kids connected and feeling like someone in that building values them.
Yeah. And I was wondering how you would do that, how you would reach out to the kids who did drop out, who did sort of fall in the cracks. How would you re-engage students in school?
So on a basic level, district leaders knock doors. They go to people's houses. I've heard of district leaders who called employers. They call the fast food restaurant and they say, you know, Jacob's supposed to be in school today. He can't work for you right now. So there's that aspect to it. And then there's, what are you getting them to come back for? How do you make them feel like they're not failures? They didn't miss out, but there's a special path for them to come back in. Maybe they can do a co-op program and work and go to school, build on skills that they acquired outside of school. Kids also, this generation gets engaged with civic responsibilities. There's a lot of activism in this generation. So figuring out how to make the curriculum relevant and speak to the concerns of kids, I think is really important too.
Do you like the idea of project-based learning that's more integrated into the real world?
Absolutely. Yes, I'm a big fan of project-based learning. And I think that we do have opportunities now because of the way that hybrid programs and remote programs are more porous to the community, and they allow students. I see, you know, a lot of what we think of as alternative visions for high school might become more mainstream. I think they should, where you can have a kid who, you know, they take some of their core courses online, some in person, and then they're learning on the community as well.
Yeah, no, that sounds fantastic, because that's something that my son, I know, would love to do. He's definitely the STEM type, loves engineering and science and doing things with his hands and building motors and 3D printing and stuff like that. How do you talk to your daughters about moving forward with school? Are they now excited to go to school? How do you engage with them around school?
That's a great question. I mean, we are starting school in just a couple of weeks now. I think they're wishing summer could last a little longer. But they are excited about the steps towards independence that they're both taking, the after-school curriculum, you know, extracurriculars that they're doing, and of course, seeing their friends and their teachers. So, you know, these are the things that there's a little bit of a hump to get over at the beginning of the school year, a new routine, getting up early in the morning. But I think all in all, I'm not too concerned about them kind of getting knit back into the fabric of school. And I'm also really happy because I have more ability now this school year to be engaged in their learning and be inside school.
Right. Well, now that you're not at NPR anymore, which
yes,
it was a great gig. Believe me, I love listening to you. But now you've got so much more free time, which is fantastic.
Yes, absolutely.
If you were able to talk to, say, a middle schooler about re-engaging in school after what everyone's been through, what would you say to a person of that age just to get them engaged?
I would ask questions, because it's really growing up in puberty in that age group, it's about finding your own why. What are the things you like about school? What are the things you don't like about school? What are the things you love doing outside of school? And how can school be more like those things? How can you make it more rewarding? Brainstorming, that kind of thing. Helping kids advocate for themselves so that they're helping talking to their teachers and their specialists about how they would like school to work for them. So it's really a time, I think, when there's a big opportunity for kids to not feel like they're the ones being nudged and pushed around, but that they have a little bit more power. And that's where the engagement comes from.
Do you think that our country can recover from this stolen year?
We can. We have to be very clear about what happened and think about why. And we have to dedicate the resources and not forget about these kids.
Anya Kamenetz's new book is The Stolen Year: How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now. Info at anyakamenetz.net. Anya, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk to you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.